Among the topics covered in Founders and the Constitution in their own words is slavery. With me this week to discuss slavery and the U.S. Constitution is Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point and the author of the essay on slavery for the Bill of Rights Institute's publication. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Good to have you. Your essay is more interesting than most I've recently read on slavery because it addresses the problem on really two different levels. First, as most would expect, you note that the existence of slavery deprived African Americans of independent lives and individual liberty for nearly 250 years. But you also suggest that slavery compromised the Republican dreams of white Americans. The first point's pretty clear, but maybe you better take a moment to explain the second.
Sure. I mean, if the founders were very much concerned that the nation was half slave and half free. And in a nation that's based on principles of liberty as well as presumptions of equality among the citizens, the notion that there would be free blacks, for example, who were perhaps released from slavery but then not allowed full citizenship struck them as very problematic. But at the same time, they weren't able to envision that former slaves would ever be able to be free and responsible citizens.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in a moment. But take us back, if you will, fill us in on the roots of slavery in the United States.
Sure. Well, the first slaves arrived in British-speaking North America in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619. A Dutch slave vessel, which was actually blown off course, landed there. And about 20 slaves got off the boat and were sold into slavery. But the primary form of labor in Virginia in the early years and in the other colonies was indentured servitude. Essentially, young English men and women would sign up for 4 to 7 years, and in exchange for passage across the Atlantic, they would come and work in the fields of the great tobacco planters of Virginia. This was a pretty good situation for the great tobacco planters at first because the indentured servants who were promised tracts of land after their term of indenture usually didn't survive that period. The life expectancy was actually very short. Once they did, once they started to survive, get their own land, and compete economically with the great planters, you began in the 1660s and 1670s to see a shift towards slavery. Slavery was essentially a good business decision for the Virginians as well as for people in South Carolina and the Caribbean and other parts of the future of the United States as well.
By 1776, though, we're not just talking about Virginia. Was slavery throughout all of the colonies? Were any at that point outlawing slavery?
The 13 original colonies all allowed slavery in 1776. And while the revolutionary movement did begin calls for gradual emancipation and by some even for abolition, northern states retained slavery for quite a long time. In fact, Connecticut did not totally abolish slavery until 1848.
Okay, now this creates an interesting situation. You write about this in your essay. For the colonies that are declaring their independence from Great Britain at the same time that they're maintaining the institution of slavery, how did this sort of contradiction play out?
The colonies, of course, when they were rebelling against Britain, oftentimes phrased their objections to British imperial policies by describing them as attempts to enslave us. Essentially, the Americans saw slavery all around them, and they knew what it did. They knew what it could do. And when they saw the British taking their money without their consent, when they saw the British limiting where they could settle and their freedom of movement, when they saw the British station troops among them, they began to get the feeling that there was a systematic attempt by the British to take away their fundamental rights and their fundamental liberties and to, as they oftentimes very frequently said, enslave them.
But even given that, in the very founding document, if we could call it that, of the nation, the Declaration of Independence, we still couldn't rid ourselves of references to slaves.
That is correct. I mean, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, in his draft, tried to include among the many things that he blamed on King George III his allowance of the transatlantic slave trade. He said that it was one of his cruelties against humanity, one of his examples of treason against the hopes of the world. And yet the representatives at the Continental Congress from Georgia and from South Carolina harshly objected and pretty much implied that they would not sign the Declaration of Independence if that anti-slave trade platform were included.
So if they weren't willing to go along with the elimination of all references in the Declaration, we would expect that slavery would be referenced in the U.S. Constitution. So maybe we should move to that and tell us about how slavery was dealt with, referenced, even protected in the U.S. Constitution.
Well, of course, the Constitution was a document that was full of compromises, and there are a couple that stand out on the issue of slavery. The first attacks the question that the Declaration was not able to begin to resolve, that is, the issue of the slave trade. There's a provision in the Constitution that the federal government cannot do anything to eliminate or curtail the slave trade for 20 years. But once those 20 years expired in 1808, the president at the time, Thomas Jefferson, was able to push through Congress and sign into law a bill that did end the importation of Africans into America. So that was one piece of the puzzle in the Constitution. The second part revolved around the issue of representation. People in the North didn't want slaves to be counted among the people who would help determine how many congressmen and members of the Electoral College various states in the South should receive. There are far more slaves in the South than in the North. People in the South, on the other hand, wanted slaves to count as full members of their population so that they would have more representatives. They pointed out, for instance, that in the North, people who were disenfranchised, people, for instance, who didn't own enough land to vote, they were counted as part of the population as well. So finally, they settled on a compromise. Slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation.
Now, as we move into the 19th century, we get into a situation where the defense of slavery grows even more strident, and that defense has an economic basis, but it also has, as you indicate in your essay, some other interesting arguments against emancipation or the dismantling of this peculiar institution.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. Tell us about, first of all, the economic defense.
Well, a big year in the history of slavery is 1793. That is the year that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, which was a machine that essentially allowed for the separation of the sticky little seeds that are bundled in with a cotton bloom from that fiber. Because those seeds had to be removed beforehand through a great deal of labor, cotton wasn't a really efficient fiber to cultivate. Once the cotton gin, which separated out those seeds, was invented, however, cotton boomed, and it really became the lifeblood of the American South, indeed to the entire economy. It was our single largest export crop. It was something akin to cotton for America in the early 19th century is like oil is to the economy of Saudi Arabia today.
So that concern would also be shared in the North among textile mill owners and so on.
That's correct. I mean, the cotton boom really spurred the market revolution in which this cotton fiber that was so valued all around the world would oftentimes be shipped up to the North where the rivers tended to run faster, where a lot of capital was willing to invest in mills. And so the textile industry grew up in places like Massachusetts and Connecticut and elsewhere. We really were becoming, as a result of the cotton that slave labor made possible, a big part of the world's economy.
Okay, now a second qualification that you, or defense of the institution of slavery, has to do with the perception of the qualifications of a citizen. How did that work?
The founders really believed that in order to be a voter, you had to be independent. You had to be economically independent, and you had to be psychologically independent. One of the reasons that early on they did have land requirements for the franchise, for voting, is that they thought that if someone didn't own their own land, if someone couldn't provide for their own basic needs and the basic needs of their family, that they could be influenced by others, that they could be bought off, or as they would say, that they could be rendered corrupt. And so as a result, the idea of allowing former slaves, people who had absolutely no independence, people who were allowed to own no property, people who couldn't even hold property in their own bodies, to allow those people to somehow become citizens after all of that conditioning and all that degradation really struck the founders as an impossible idea.
A third explanation you offer that I think is also important to remind us here is the religious or Christian justification for African-American slavery. Summarize that for us.
Sure. I mean, during the 1830s in the North, a lot of people were inspired to call for an end to slavery. The Second Great Awakening led a number of preachers to point out that we are all equal in the eyes of God. And yet this provoked a counterreaction in the South, where a doctrine known as pro-slavery thought began to emerge. And there was a religious component of it. Essentially, it held that Africans in Africa were pagans. They had not found Jesus. They had not been Christianized. Their souls had not been saved. But here in America, they were not only cared for and civilized, but also Christianized. And so Southerners began to reason that slavery for Africans was in fact a good thing.
I think it's important here to remind our listeners that all three of these arguments were not necessarily located exclusively in the South, whether it's the economic defense, as we mentioned earlier, or the qualifications as citizens, or the idea of the Christian justification. These were ideas that were shared really both north and south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, I think that's true. What you really begin to see happening, however, is during the market revolution, the positions of both sides begin to solidify as politicians begin to look west, as well as regular American citizens, and begin to try to understand whether the West is going to look more like the North or more like the South.
So the West is really a driving factor here.
It really is. I mean, when Thomas Jefferson signed into law the Louisiana Purchase, it solved many problems for America. The idea that there would be a powerful European presence on the North American continent was essentially wiped away. But it did open up this big question about how these lands would be settled, whether these lands would be places that would be home to slave labor or whether they would exclusively be reserved for free labor.
Now, this was dealt with fairly early on in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. So tell us a little bit about how that came about and what were the provisions included in that.
Well, certainly. I'll have to take us back 3 years before that to 1784. Thomas Jefferson was a member of the Continental Congress at the time. He actually proposed that slavery should be banned west of the Appalachian Mountains, all the way from the Great Lakes down toward the Gulf of Mexico. So the future states of Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee and Kentucky, all of those states would not have had slavery. Jefferson's proposal, his ordinance of 1784, was defeated by only one vote. And as a result, 3 years later, the Continental Congress was able to compromise on the Northwest Ordinance. It drew the line at the Ohio River. Anywhere north of the Ohio, slavery would be banned. Anywhere south of the Ohio, slavery would be allowed. And it leads to this really remarkable scene in Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he describes standing on the banks of the Ohio. And he looks north toward Ohio, and he sees industry and improvement and all these people working very hard. And he looks south into Kentucky, and he sees nothing but lethargy and sloth. He sees slaves not particularly caring about the work that they were forced to do, and he sees whites who were used to the slaves doing all of the work.
Does this really just kind of extend the references to slavery and the existence of slavery north? It's almost like taking the Mason-Dixon line, it seems to me, and extending it across the rest of the country, which many people have referenced in terms of the Missouri Compromise.
Absolutely.
Line.
The Missouri Compromise would extend that line further west. Then Texas would be admitted to the Union. Then you have the Compromise of 1850, which admits California as a free state, imposes the doctrine of popular sovereignty, which would allow voters to decide on whether or not there would be slavery in other emerging Western territories. So yeah, I mean, it really delays the decision about slavery, and it really extends the divide between the North and the South all the way out to the Pacific Ocean.
Why couldn't the compromise last forever and avoid civil war?
I think it's really a question of political representation and distrust on both sides. Obviously, there were plenty of people in the North and a small number, a very small number in the South, who were absolutely committed to eradicating this form of human injustice. At the same time, it was the lifeline of the South. To ask Southerners in the 1800s to give up slavery would be like asking modern Americans to give up fossil fuels. It was absolutely necessary to their way of life as they knew it. And when you see Abraham Lincoln getting elected in 1860 with his name not even appearing on the ballot in 10 southern states, the South is convinced that it is now going to be frozen into a permanent minority, that Lincoln will not allow any more slave states to enter the Union, and that eventually the North will use its political power to eradicate slavery throughout the Union.
Okay, we only have a minute left, but you conclude your essay, I won't say by condemning, but issuing a certain amount of blame as far as the founders were concerned, suggesting that Americans paid dearly for their failure really to come to terms or to deal with the institution of slavery. I don't want to put words in your mouth, so let me ask you, how much responsibility do they bear for what followed?
I think it's certainly fair to say that they had a great opportunity to do something about slavery. In fairness to them, I think that we should say that they did. I mean, remember, it was Thomas Jefferson who eradicated the transatlantic slave trade. It was Congress, even before the Constitution, that prohibited the expansion of slavery north of the Ohio River. There were a number of northern states that instituted programs of gradual emancipation. In the South, even, states like Virginia, all the way up until the 1830s, flirted with the notion of instituting programs of gradual emancipation. So they really did try to do something. They really did understand the paradox. They really did want to live in a nation that, rather than being half slave and half free, was entirely free, with all of its citizens living at liberty. But I think the special understanding and appreciation of freedom that the founding generation had was lost on the groups that followed, especially when the North and the South got into a shouting match and developed their different ideologies, either justifying or condemning slavery. The time for compromise had really passed, and I think that we were on the road to a civil war that, as you know, resulted in the loss of 600,000 American lives.
And that's where we'll have to end it. So thank you, Robert, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point and the author of an essay on slavery for the Founders and the Constitution series. McDonald is currently working on a book to be titled Confounding Father, Thomas Jefferson and the Politics of Personality. This is Talking History.
God bless our native land, firm may she ever stand through storm and night. When the wild tempest rave, ruler of wind and wave, do thou our country save by thy great might. For her our prayer shall rise to God above the skies, on him we wait. Lord, hear our nation's cry, may freedom never die, be thou ever nigh, God save the state.